As an extension of our consideration of cooperative interactions, we'll now turn to symbioses or symbiotic interactions. Now, a symbiotic interaction is an interaction that occurs between two organisms, and it's typically a very intimate interaction. Often one of the organisms is smaller, while the other is a larger organism, such as a microorganism living inside of, for example, an animal's gut would be an example of a symbiosis. Now, not all symbioses are cooperative, and in fact, there are a number of symbioses that are anything but cooperative when you have parasites interacting with host organisms, for example. And this is something that we'll see in the next chapter, not this one. In this chapter, we're going to emphasize particularly the interaction between organisms that are cooperative in either symbiotic interactions or a special case of symbiotic interactions, which are endosymbiotic interactions. We'll break the talk up into two parts. One part will be on symbioses between microorganisms or microorganisms and larger organisms, and the other second part will be on endosymbioses. So symbioses. So our next step is to consider endosymbioses. Now, endosymbioses are symbioses. They just happen to be ones in which one of the species lives inside of the cell or cells of another species. Now, the most familiar of the endosymbionts, or at least derivatives of endosymbionts, are the mitochondria and the chloroplast, or more generally, plastids. There are, however, variations on both what mitochondria are and what plastids are. And in addition, there are a substantial number of other bacteria, especially, that serve as endosymbionts of other organisms. And they play various roles in the functioning of these other organisms. So this part of this lecture on symbioses is on endosymbioses. So endosymbioses. So now we'll turn briefly from endosymbiosis as one sees in algae to endosymbiosis as one sees in insects. And we'll start with the bacterium Buchnera, and that's an insect endosymbiont. So Buchnera supplies amino acids to insects, such as aphids. And aphids subsist on this nutrient-poor diet that consists of the sap of plants. So plants have sap that is deficient in amino acids, and this limits the number of insects that are able, or herbivores generally, that are able to subsist solely on the sap of the plants. But the aphids have a way of addressing this, and that is that inside of them they have bacteria that supply them with the amino acids that are missing in their diet. So this Buchnera, these bacteria are maternally transmitted. They're transmitted in association with the egg, just like mitochondria. There are about 100 copies per cell, but the genome of the individual Buchnera cells is substantially reduced, about 1/7 of that which you see in E. coli. They're strangely aerobic, but lack in a Krebs cycle. They have few DNA repair enzymes, and as a consequence, they seem to display high mutation rates. And they also exist in only one type of highly specialized cell, something called a bacteriocyte, that's found within a specialized organ within the aphid. About 10% of insects bear intracellular microorganisms, with many of them similar to the Buchnera, and this is similar in their function, not necessarily phylogenetically similar. Typically, in insects that display an unbalanced diet, you find these kinds of bacteria. And so the diet, like with the aphids, is missing in amino acids. The diet may be missing in other nutrients that the insects on their own can't make up for. But the intracellular endosymbionts, in fact, can make up for. The aphid Buchnera symbiosis is a model system, and the Buchnera make up about 90% of the bacteria that are found in association with aphids, which is a lot. So this is an aphid, and these are where the Buchnera are found. That's actually a Buchnera bacterium itself, and they're found in association with these bacteriocyte cells. Buchnera is found in the specialized organs that are found in a location that allows a depositing of the Buchnera on the eggs, and as a consequence, Buchnera is able to colonize the next generation as well. And so you have a passing of the bacteria, the intracellular endosymbiont, onto the Buchnera, even though the endosymbiont is not actually found in the eggs of the aphid. Initially, they're in a sense added to the eggs in the course of egg development. And this results in a co-vertical transmission. So the Buchnera are passed down to the progeny just as the genes associated with the aphid are passed down to the progeny. And this has a potential to select for increased amount of cooperation between the endosymbiont and the host. And indeed, apparently, that's the case. You've seen this streamlining of the association. And of course, the Buchnera appear to be mutualistic symbionts helping out the aphids and their ability to gather up resources from the environment, making up for deficiencies in their normal diet. Another endosymbiont is associated with aphids also, and it actually is an endosymbiont that can be beneficial to the aphid, but only under circumstances where wasps attempt to parasitoidize the aphid, that is, deposit eggs that can then grow within the aphid. It can be described as a conditional endosymbiont because, or at least conditional in its beneficial effects, because wasp infestations only occasionally occur. So it's an endosymbiont that's present and may be only occasionally useful to the aphid. There's an example of a bacterial endosymbiont that is in fact found within a bacterial endosymbiont. So you can have what can be described as a secondary bacterial endosymbiont found in an endosymbiont, a bacterial endosymbiont of mealybugs. The inner endosymbiont is derived from a bacterium and is surrounded by two membranes. And the outer endosymbiont is derived from a bacterium, also a different bacterium, and is surrounded by three membranes. And this appears to be a hitherto, at least in 2003, unprecedented case of a prokaryotic endosymbiont with a prokaryotic host, a remarkable example of endosymbiosis. This is our mealybugs. And what we have here is this thing right here is the three membrane endosymbiont, the outer endosymbiont in blue. And the two membrane endosymbiont that's found within the three membrane endosymbiont is red. And this is the nucleus of the mealybug cell. And this is a diagrammatic representation of this. So that's the nucleus right there. That's the outer endosymbiont, and that's the inner endosymbiont. The red ovals are the inner endosymbiont. So it's a prokaryote within a prokaryote within a eukaryote in a cell that makes up an animal. Another kind of endosymbiosis, at which we've already mentioned, is the endosymbioses that are associated with legume root nodules. And in this case, what we have is a taking up of otherwise free-living bacteria, the rhizobia. And the rhizobia are then brought into the plant and end up inside of the cells of the plant. There they are supplied with nutrients and supplied with an environment that fosters the ability of the rhizobia to fix nitrogen. And the nitrogen, of course, is made available to the plants. There's also the issue which we've been hinting at, the concept of the transfer of genes from the endosymbiont's genome to the nucleus of the host organism. So transfers from organelles to the nucleus, both recent and ancient, are probably much, much more abundant than previously assumed. A recent genome-wide study revealed that about 18% of the nuclear encoded proteins in Arabidopsis, which is a kind of plant, come from cyanobacteria, that is, from the ancestral plastid genome. This is a surprisingly large contribution from a plastid. Yet the more burning question of how many genes in eukaryotes ultimately come from the ancestral mitochondrial genome is currently under heavy debate. Because the mitochondria are more ancient than the plastids, and also because the mitochondria either were in or are in all of the existing eukaryotes that we can look at, it's difficult to figure out how many of the genes in the eukaryotic genome came from the mitochondria. Whereas with the plastids, by contrast, what we have are organisms that are only a fraction of the total number of eukaryotes. So to figure out how many plastid genes made it into a eukaryotic genome, it's relatively easy. One has to compare the genes in a algae with those in a non-algae eukaryote. And ideally, given our previous discussions, a non-algae eukaryote that in fact never was an algae, didn't have a plastid, and then lost that plastid. So we also have the question of which supplied more genes to the eukaryote nuclei, either the presumptive eukaryotic ancestral cell, which presumably was an archaeum, but we don't know this for sure, versus the endosymbiotic bacterium, the mitochondria. And in fact, the origin of the eukaryotic cells, we'll get to in the next chapter, likely came about as some kind of fusion, perhaps in terms of acquisition of a mitochondrion, between an archaean and a bacterium. Note that these ideas of endosymbiont to nucleus transfer of genes is somewhat equivalent to the you are what you eat hypothesis, the idea that if a gene finds its way into the cytoplasm, it can find its way into the nucleus and then find its way integrating into the nuclear genome, into the chromosomes, and thereby become a part of that nuclear genome. And what we have here is the integration of DNA that comes from the bacterium Wolbachia, which is here found in the chromosome of an insect host. Now, Wolbachia is a strange case of organism that can serve as a parasite in some circumstances and as a commensal or mutualist under other circumstances. And to remind you of the idea of transfer to the nucleus and its similarity to a from endosymbionts and its similarity to the you are what you eat hypothesis. So you've got bacteria that find their way into the cytoplasm as endosymbionts. They have genomes. It's very equivalent to the idea of the phagocytosis of a organism that then finds its way into the cytoplasm. In this case, in the case of food for the sake of digestion, but in either case, there's the potential for a spilling of the genes into the cytoplasm. The genes then can make their way into the nucleus, and from there, there's a potential for integration into the nuclear genome. So this is actually shown right here, where you've got a mitochondrion and the transfer of its DNA into the nucleus. And again, all of this happens accidentally. There's nothing driving this except that it can happen. And because it can happen, it kind of moves things forward. And actually, it happens at a high enough rate that you eventually have losses of most of the genes of these endosymbionts and their replacement functionally by the genes as they're now found in the nuclear genome with the proteins, the gene products that these genes produce, then being transported back from the cytoplasm after they're translated, transcribed, and then translated into the endosymbiont as functional proteins. Then there's the wonderful you are what you eat, what you live on, what lives on you, what lives in you hypothesis. Again, this is basically the idea that there's DNA out there. DNA that's out there has some potential of finding its way into the cytoplasm of a cell. If once it's found its way into the cytoplasm, it has some potential of making its way into the nucleus. And once in the nucleus, it has some potential of integrating into the nuclear genome. And the higher the likelihood that DNA can find its way into the cytoplasm, the higher the likelihood that it's going to make its way into the nuclear genome. Now, in animals, the soma is much more likely to come in contact with this environmental DNA. And as a consequence, because the soma does not directly contribute to the germ line, the production of gametes, is actually relatively hard for the environmental DNA to make its way into the genomes of animals. Although this does occur in some strange circumstances, nevertheless, the system that we're most used to with the animals actually is one that's relatively resistant to the acquisition of this environmental DNA. Whereas in other systems, in fact, the likelihood of acquisition of environmental DNA can be much, much higher. So here we have an algae, a eukaryotic algae. This is its plastid, that's its nucleus right here. The plastid came, assuming this is a primary endosymbiotic event, the plastid came from a free-living cyanobacterium. That bacterium had somewhere between 1.5 and 7,000, 1,500 and 7,000 genes, and that's comparable to the approximately 4,000 genes that are associated with E. coli. But the plastid actually has a relatively few number of genes, roughly 100 to 200 genes. And so these genes that were in the original cyanobacterium obviously have gone away. Where have they gone to? Well, to the extent there's a redundancy between the two genomes to begin with, you'll have the selective loss of genes to streamline the system, but also a number of these genes via this you are what you eat like mechanism of transfer move to the nucleus. And in the nucleus, these genes were expressed, and the gene products that were produced in the cytoplasm find their way back to the cyanobacteria and functionally replace the products of genes that originally were found in the cyanobacterium. So plastids, their DNA contains only about 1 to 3% as many genes as that are found in cyanobacteria. Yet plastids typically contain about as many proteins as their cyanobacterial cousins. And so what this means is that there are cyanobacterial proteins that in fact are encoded by now nuclear genes that find their way back into the cyanobacterium. So these are the original genes. These are the genes that actually were retained in the cyanobacterium. And then this is the movement of cyanobacterial genes to the nucleus is basically an inevitable consequence of a combination of this idea that if DNA finds its way into the cytoplasm, it will then find its way into the nucleus, in combination with the idea that the genes that are found in the nucleus are more stable because of lower mutation rates and a relative absence of Müller's ratchet than those that are found in the cytobacterium. So you have an alternative kind of ratcheting action where the genes that are associated with the endosymbionts tend to be replaced by genes that have been captured by the nucleus. And part of this whole process is that these genes still are expressed and still generate proteins, and those proteins still have to find their way back to the endosymbiont. And as a consequence of this, the endosymbiont can retain a fairly substantial number of proteins, despite the fact that it only retains a relatively small number of the original genes that were associated with the free-living bacterium before it was captured as an endosymbiont. So there's protein movement back to the plastid, or the endosymbiont generally. And in fact, these genes that become nuclear genes and are expressed don't just produce proteins that move back to the plastid, but actually produce proteins that can be used elsewhere in the cell. Wherever a protein can be useful, if a mutation or shuffling and duplication of DNA can cause that protein to be available in that location, then what we can have is selection for retention of a gene for reasons other than simply replacing cyanobacterial genes. The genes, in fact, can be, their products can in fact be useful elsewhere in the cell. So it's a way of building up the gene repertoire of an organism, not just in terms of its ability to take care of its endosymbiont, but just generally. So this is another representation of these general ideas of movement of genes, DNA, from an endosymbiont into the nucleus, and then what happens then. So the endosymbiont, it finds its way into a host cell. There's redundancy in functionality, and basically there are functions that are no longer needed by the endosymbiont for it to thrive, and you have mutation and genetic drift and natural selection eliminating those genes, that DNA that's no longer necessary. In the course of this, there's a streamlining of the whole endosymbiont host combination. They're turning more into just a single organism rather than a combination of two organisms. There's also, via the you are what you eat mechanism of this movement, this ongoing movement of DNA from the endosymbiont into the nucleus. This occurs accidentally, but it's a consequence of the fact that DNA that finds its way into the cytoplasm could find its way into the nucleus and thereby find its way into the nuclear genome. Once there, there can be acquisition of eukaryotic control sequences by these pieces of DNA, these genes that have been acquired by the nuclear genome. There can be duplications and exon shuffling and functional reassignment of these genes. Basically, you come up with new genes. Some of these genes are expressed, and their protein products, in fact, move back to the endosymbiont. At that point, you've got, again, a functional redundancy, and it is going to be the endosymbiont that loses the genes that are redundant rather than the nucleus, because again, the genes found in the nucleus are more stable than those found in the endosymbiont because of a combination of lower mutation rates and also the potential to participate in sex, which eliminates the concerns of Mueller's ratchet. But nevertheless, there's ongoing genomic erosion in the nuclear genome as well. So genes that find their way, DNA that finds its way from the endosymbiont into the nucleus, but then subsequently doesn't become under positive selection or come under positive selection, will tend to be lost from the nuclear genome. So the endosymbionts, like mitochondria and plastids, they retain their genomes. They're greatly smaller genomes. They're greatly eroded genomes compared to their genomes of their free-living ancestors, but nevertheless, they do retain genomes. And then the question is, why do they retain genomes? Why don't all the genes simply move to the nucleus and then the protein products of their genes migrate back again? In the hydrogenosomes and the mitosomes, in fact, it seems to be the case that they've lost all of their genomes, and yet they're still functional as organelles within the eukaryotic cell. And so what is the reason why, in fact, you have retention of these genes in the genomes why do you have genomes in these remnant endosymbionts that serve as organelles, such as mitochondria and plastids? So there's two main theories to explain the presence of mitochondrial genomes. And one is the hydrophobicity theory, and the other is the colocation for redox regulation hypothesis. So the first theory, the hydrophobicity theory, it suggests that the mitochondria retain those genes that they have because they have properties, their products, their gene products, have properties such that it makes it difficult to move the products back into the mitochondria or plastid or whatever the endosymbiont is. In fact, this is something that I've sort of alluded to when I was talking about tertiary endosymbiosis, where you've got these plastids that in fact retain their nuclear genome. One argument is that the genome is there, the nuclear genome is there, because these are young endosymbiotic events, and therefore you simply haven't lost the genome. But another argument is that these tertiary endosymbiotic products simply have way too many membranes that makes it difficult for nuclear genes to produce proteins that can find their way back into the right spots inside of these plastids. So this would be the hydrophobicity and membrane topology hypothesis, essentially the idea that not all protein products, in fact, can be shuttled back into the endosymbiont, but it's easier, in fact, to just retain the protein producing machinery in the endosymbiont and instead have the proteins produced in there. So the hydrophobicity and membrane topologies of the products would not allow their import into the mitochondria if translated in the cytoplasm of the eukaryotic host. The latter states, this is the redox regulation, that mitochondria retain a genome because this enables them to regulate expression of tightly depending upon the redox state of the organelle. Remember that the mitochondria is responsible for making ATP, and it does so in the presence of oxygen, and you would imagine that there'd be some regulation of ATP production and the amount of different mitochondrial molecules that are involved in this ATP production, and it might have something to do with O2 presence, oxygen presence, and it just may be easier to regulate the production of a protein if in fact you're regulating it in the same microenvironment that is subject to these various forces, oxygen concentrations, and things like the redox state of the organelle, that is, the number of electrons that the largest cell is trying to donate to the mitochondria. Because the mitochondrial genes that exist today mostly encode hydrophobic proteins involved in bioenergetic processes that are absent in mitochondrial remnant organelles, both of these hypotheses, in fact, could explain the absence of a genome in these latter organelles, but the presence of the genome in the mitochondria. So it's a tough question. We have genes, they seem to inevitably move into the nucleus, yet they haven't all moved into the nucleus. So we have a mystery of sorts as to why it is that not all of them have moved. Lastly, we'll turn to nucleomorphs, and nucleomorphs are something that have been mentioned but not in name. So these are remnant genomes that are found in secondary endosymbiotic plastids. These are remnant nuclear genomes. So in other words, the nucleus was there at the point of acquisition of the plastid of a red algae or a green algae, but then that nuclear genome has been lost. And that's to be expected, assuming that the larger cell can export proteins from its cytoplasm and into the plastid successfully, thereby replacing what previously were plastid proteins. But nevertheless, if you're catching the process of streamlining of these algae early enough, then you may have reached a point where you haven't completely lost all of the nuclear genome. And these are two groups, the chlorarcniphytes and the cryptophytes, that both have these remnant nuclear genomes in their plastids, which again are called nucleomorphs. This is different from the substantial nuclear genomes that are found in those dinoflagellates, products of tertiary endosymbiosis that we talked about. So what you can actually have in these cells are four genomes: a mitochondrial genome, the plastid genome, meaning the plastid that was associated with the red or green algae that was itself acquired as a plastid, the nucleomorph, which also is a plastid genome, but it's actually a nuclear genome found within the plastid, and then of course the nuclear genome of the eukaryotic cell itself. These guys are the nuclear morph is of green algae origin, and those guys, it's of red algae origin. So all other secondary plastid-containing algae have, through a combined effects of gene loss and intracellular gene transfer, completely eliminated their endosymbiont nuclear genome. That is, all products of secondary endosymbiosis, except for the chlorarachnephytes and the cryptophytes. Have lost their nuclear genomes within their plastids, but these guys have retained them, and these remnants we call nuclear morphs. So, what we're talking about in the previous slide are these plastids here, and we're talking about a retention of the genes here in this nucleus. What had been this nucleus right here, these genes tend to be lost. As we have a streamlining, an evolution, a coevolution of the products of the secondary endosymbiosis, the algae. But in some of these algae, in fact, there has been a retention of nuclear genes, in addition to, of course, genes that are associated with the cyanobacterium, the original cyanobacterium itself.